We made this. Welcome to The Time Is Now.
My name is Kurt North.
Soylent Green is people. Today is our guest Adam Chamberlain. He's back from the primer, which we did at the very beginning of the show during our first initial episodes there with John Kenneth Muir. And he's back to discuss the beginning and the end. Welcome back to the show, Adam. How does it feel to actually be talking about an actual episode today?
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's great to be back. And yeah, it feels very good to be talking about an actual episode and focusing in on that. And looking forward to it.
Well, I think because it's we are at season two, the things that we discussed in the primer in broad strokes and similar to what we did there, I think we need to kind of look at what season two did as a whole and what the background of season two was. We get from season two a big shift in that James Wan and Glen Morgan were asked by Fox to take over the show and run it themselves. Something that Chris Carter wasn't really aware of to begin with, but he did actually back them to begin with. What are your general thoughts on season two as a whole and some of the aspects around that change and the change in style of from season one to season two?
Yeah, so when I first started watching season two the first time around, it was a little jarring. There were certain elements that I found a little jarring in the continuity from Paper Dove, from the finale of season one, but also just in terms of the tone in general. But as it went on, I absolutely went with the flow and loved it. And as I think I mentioned in the primer, it's probably my favorite season of television. Period.
Yeah, I mean, I've literally just said that to somebody on our Facebook group. I think it was either Facebook or the XCast basement, where I said that, you know, I think it is one of my favorite seasons of TV. As well, it's so unique and so gonzo and out there in points, which is kind of my thing. I'm a big fan of David Lynch, and obviously we get into like sort of Time Is Now and the Four Horsemen there later on in the season. That, you know, that is very Lynchian. But one aspect of season two which is a major difference from season one is that season one was referred to sometimes wrongly of a serial killer of the week. And the one, I think I even mentioned this in the primer as well, saying that the Wongs held a t-shirt where it said 98% less serial killers. We do have serial killers in the season. We do have episodes like the Mikado and episodes like that where we do feature serial killers. So that whole change from serial killers to more of an abstract kind of season, and also a thematic through line through the whole of the show. I mean, being your favorite seasons in TV, what makes it that? What are the main sort of bullet points that you would point to that really kind of talks to you as a season as a whole?
Yeah, so it's still got some of those core elements of Millennium in terms of that exploration of evil. It's looking at different types of evil and evil in different places, perhaps. But I think it's the sheer breadth of imagination that Glen Morgan and James Wong and those who work with them brought to the sort of core idea of Millennium and where they take the character of Frank Black in particular and the epic journey that they take him on from the start to end of the season. I think some of the introduction of humor, I think I said before, you always get extra points for having a couple of Darren Morgan episodes in a season. That helps to elevate things as well. And ultimately, I think perhaps it does help to broaden the canvas of the series at this point and broaden the range of ideas that can be brought to the series. Just hit some real creative highs.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm a huge mythology fan of the X-Files, and Millennium, as you say, starts to broaden out quite a bit with season two. I mean, the overt mythology is obviously the likes of Hand of Saint Sebastian, Owls and Roosters, The Fourth Horseman and Time Is Now. But you can even look at the two episodes like Beware of the Dog, which is next, Monster, Single Blade of the Grass, and the two really interesting holiday episodes in The Curse of Frank Black and Midnight of the Century, which are particular highlights of the season for me, which are very, very abstract overall. But that's one of the reasons why I love them, that you do have this through line of a journey, as you say, like a hero's journey of Frank. I mean, he's been dismantled so much over the course of season one that, you know, we're really seeing the after effects of that. And I think that season two really works well in regards to that. What about the kind of the changing of the Millennium Group? I think we'll get into this during the episode, but the fact that we start off in season one with the Academy Group aspect of the Millennium Group. So the Academy Group were ex-FBI people who in real life consulted, but then the Millennium Group takes a big change, a big sort of right-hand turn as such. What did you think overall of the Millennium Group's change? And we're going to be talking a little bit during the episode about the particulars of that. But what did you think overall of the group?
Yeah, I didn't have a problem with it. And I know some people compare the Millennium Group to the Academy Group, and they think it's somehow, you know, not right that you could portray the Millennium Group in such a way that might seem to shine a bad light on the Academy Group. But I think you just have to view them as different things, and just think that that was an inspiration coming from the Academy Group, but it's definitely a different beast. And I think it's interesting, and it is part of that exploration of evil, that actually looking at a group like this of experts with all the dogma that they have at their core and the sort of schisms that open up. I think it's it plays into some of the bigger themes of Millennium in a new and interesting way.
Well, I think before we, I think that's it really. I think that's all we need to discuss season two. We're bound to speak to it. I'm sure the likes of Darren Mooney and Chris Knowles are going to have a fantastic time discussing season two. For example, I'm sure Tony will be back in as well, and he'll be discussing a lot of season two as well. So those are discussions that are going to be really interesting to get their takes on it. But for now, we need to look at the beginning and the end. So before further ado, let's jump into the episode. This episode is The Beginning and the End, and it aired on the 19th of September, 1997. It's directed by Thomas J. Wright and is written by none other than Glenn Morgan and James Wong. They actually ended up writing 12 episodes of the season, which I think is about 51% of the episode. So it really does have a Morgan and Wong stamp on the entire season. So this is the first of them. I think obviously they did the three or four in season one, but this is the first one where they're the show running. Do you want to hazard a guess at the IMDb rating? I know this is a loaded question. Have you had a look at it, or would you like to hazard a guess?
I haven't had a look at it. I would guess it scores something around a 7.
Okay, it's actually received 8.1.
Oh, that pleases me. Okay,
yeah, so good. it's quite high in the list of episodes, which is great. So, what would you consider this episode to be?
Actually, about an 8, and I'm not just copying the rating now. I thought the rating might be a little lower, but this is an episode that I would have given a slightly lower rating to, I think, probably the first time I watched it. But whenever I go back to this episode, I just think more and more of it each time I revisit it. So, I would say it's a solid 8.
I would agree with that. I actually had 8 as well. I think that the episode as a whole is, it's effectively an episode of a checklist, effectively like saying what it wants to get to the audience and what it's dismantling from season one and also moving forward.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of elements that are sprinkled in that's kind of going to be looking at what we're going to do for the next sort of 22, 23 episodes of season two, really. So the story is, for me, is fairly straightforward. It's, you know, the actual story itself is Frank loses girl, Frank goes after girl, Frank gets girl. So it's a very, an interesting but fairly simple, straightforward story. But the elements that are within it are definitely something to bear in mind and to see. We are going to be changing from season one to season two. With the opening credits, the closed open, it really emphasises that for me. It puts us into the realm of the cosmic with these three potential ends of this comet that we see in Frank's monologue over the top of it. Mm-hmm. We've got the apocalypse, disintegration to nothing, or crash and burn into the yellow sun. So it's rather poetic, and it has far-reaching implications, even as far as the time is now at the end as well. And I believe that you've actually got the original script, and you've got some insight into some of the actual opening and the rest of the episode, have you? Do you?
I do, yeah. So, and I don't have many, but I have a handful of scripts from Millennium, and I almost forgot I had this. I just found it last night. Thought to go and look for it, and it just struck me how, as you say, it's a beautiful opening monologue, beautifully performed by Lance Henriksen. But the whole of this cold open is just, to me, it's so beautifully, poetically written on the page in a way that some scripts aren't. But if I can just. So I'm not going to read any of the monologue itself, but just the first couple of sentences, the first few sentences, I think are beautiful in terms of setting up those opening moments. So it reads as follows: beneath the darkness of mystery and fear arise two prayers. First, our initial call to God. Ancient instruments build a faint primal percussive rhythm ascending toward heaven. Second, although remaining focused and strong, the voice of Frank Black is more tense and shaken than we have ever known, quietly begging a desperate question toward anyone or anywhere that may provide an answer.
Right.
And it goes on. But yeah, I just love that. I sat and started reading this last night and I couldn't put it down as I was reading back through it. I think it's just beautifully written on the page.
Did it give any inkling on who the voiceover was going to be read by, or is it just...
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely Frank through here. Right. I mean, it's okay. Line for line what you see on screen. What I find interesting in here is that there's even sort of direction on the music, on the score, some of which doesn't appear in the final version, but some of which certainly does. But in terms of that monologue itself, yeah, it's word for word as you hear it on screen. Yeah.
The word definite change, or definitive change, never again will be the same, is a nice little nod to both the character portrayal of Frank Black and the show itself. I think it's not lost to me that that's a bit of metatextual information there, really. Absolutely. Saying you're going to see something else. What did you think of the comet motif over the course of the season?
Yeah, as I said, I think it works really, really well. It gives that sense of foreboding, this notion of it as a sort of herald, prophecy of extraordinary events to come. I think it here it sends a clear message in terms of Glenn Morgan and James Wong setting out their stall, I think, and I think it's a very powerful motif.
We go back to where we were at the end of Paper Dove. Paper Dove is an episode which is very much an episode that's based on the serial killer of the week event, but he has the Polaroid man working in tandem with him. It doesn't really touch on it too much. I think there's maybe three scenes in total that where we see the Polaroid.
Yeah.
And I think that the use of it is an interesting one, especially for a season ender, that we get Catherine being kidnapped at the very end of the episode and we don't know what's happened to her. One, what did you think of the ending? I know you weren't on the last episode with me, but what did you think of that ending to Paper Dove? And how do you think the elements are picked up here? What are your kind of aspects of that you think?
It almost feels low key, the ending of Paper Dove. Yeah. It's quite underplayed, I think. And certainly the character of the Polaroid stalker, as you say, there's this sense that he's directing Henry Dion, the killer there, the killer of the week, if you like, in Paper Dove, that gets dropped here. But certainly coming back, and when Doug Hutchison shows up and does what he does, it almost didn't feel like quite the same character.
It's played literally.
Literally. But it's certainly played a lot more broadly. But perhaps that's a smart thing to do. So bringing someone like Doug Doug Hutchison in, who, of course, to X-Files fans is known as Eugene Toomes. Yeah. Perhaps that's a way of bringing some of the X-Files audience along as well. This well-known and liked actor for his guest role in the X-Files. Again, it was one of the things that jarred with me when I first watched it, but I go with it now, on rewatching the episode, certainly.
Doug Hutchison, I've actually been rewatching Lost recently as well, and I've literally just got into the part where Doug Hutchison appears in there as well. And he is an interesting actor and certainly does this job really, really well. And we'll get into the scene with Catherine in a bit later on, which is obviously a highlight of the episode. Morgan and Wong kind of trope of using music, which we get here, which is again later on goes well beyond anything we've got here. But do you like the aspect that Morgan and Wong do use throughout both the X-Files and here, and a lot of their work by choosing songs, especially like Wonderful, Wonderful, for example?
I do. It's really effective. I absolutely love that. And obviously there's some great examples of that coming up in this season. I guess in this episode, I see it slightly differently. It's a means of, I think, of the Polaroid Stalker to avoid detection, at least initially, and this isn't one of my favourite uses of song in a Morgan and Wong episode, but I think it's effective narratively as much as anything else.
Another checklist that I need to tick off is the resetting of the Millennium Group. At this point, where we are signalled very much that the Millennium Group are now an entity, with them coming through the airport lounge there, and they literally come through as if there's almost, you can only just, you could potentially imagine a flaming fireball behind them.
Absolutely.
That's the walkthrough.
It's very much a hero shot, and I believe it's actually called out as a hero shot in the script as well.
Is so it?
Very clearly signalled as that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is a hero shot. It's low, it's looking up at them, so it's all of everything that's being told there is that you're looking at this hero shot of them coming through the airport doors, and as I say, with the camera being low and looking up at them, you know, that naturally feels like something that's empowering and emboldening. Absolutely. And you know, there's a group of them as well, which is not, it's not just Peter coming through on his own, you know, not being the man to save the day. It's a group of them, some of which we've seen earlier on. So I really like that aspect of it. The pulsating score as well. I don't know if there's anything in the script for that, but the score is also kind of foreboding, and you know, this is telling us that this year is going to be really different.
Yes, absolutely.
Which leads me to my next kind of aspect of not only this episode, but things that this is playing into for the rest of the season, is this cult mentality that the Millennium Group have, whether it be Masonic or cult in general. I mean, this came out again. I was talking about the field where I died recently and how much cult was involved in there. When Millennium started, the cult aspect of things started to pick up, and we get things like Gehenna in season one. There's a lot of aspects in this show, in this season, where we get Frank Black being told that Frank Black tells us that he's feeling anger and he's feeling helplessness.
Yeah.
And a lot of cult mentality builds on people with low self-esteem or promote the illusion of safety and you know, all this kind of the thing that cults do.
Yeah.
And you get aspects of like Peter Watts saying things like, you know, this is why the Millennium Group is here and why it always has been, which is something that's a massive change that you kind of see in that. So, and with the cult also satisfying human desire for getting, you know, answers, you mean the answers to the questions and all of that aspect of it, I think really works quite well through the whole season. But this is where we're kind of getting the idea that at the moment, we've got none of that there, but there's the hint when Peter does say, you know, it's where we've always have been. That's kind of the hint that, you know, something is going on there.
Absolutely.
Also as well, just while we're talking about the Millennium Group, it brings in a bit of an X-File trope as well with the introduction of a shadowy figure. So we've got the guys later on saying, you know, we're only doing what we should have done by now, help him.
Yes. And that's one of the scenes that I almost sort of struggled with a little bit, because it's kind of, well, okay, there's a sense that we have later that they knew about the Polaroid story. They knew who he was. And they were just kind of monitoring it, not revealing it and testing Frank. And then they say, oh, what were we doing, what we should have done earlier. I'm just kind of, well, make your minds up, guys. that's a slightly odd scene to me. Yeah.
Yeah. And going exactly, I mean, going to that point, as well, where you're saying that we kind of have this feeling that they are holding back answers, that we have got this kind of Illuminati. It's only what people need to know. And Frank gets his hackles up a little bit with the fact that, he knew all along about Alias and everything, but you didn't tell us. Why didn't you tell me? And then Peter basically shrugs that off. And we get that a lot in the first part of the season, which is filtered through a lot of the first part of the season, where we find things that Peter's holding back from him. And even Catherine even challenges Peter at some point as well. So
yes.
We have this cultish feel to it. We have this Illuminati and messianic feel to it as well. And I think that this is the beginning of that. And you can see it being just woven in, just literally giving hints of what's to come, which I really like.
Absolutely, yeah. And it almost, I was struck by the contrast as well. So in early in season one in Gehenna, I think, so Frank shows the photos that he's received to Mike Atkins and asks for his opinion. And Mike sort of gives him a bit of a profile and says, well, yeah, I don't think there's any danger of this escalating and so on. And perhaps connecting dots that were never meant to be connected. I'm thinking, okay, was Mike Atkins in on this? Was this something that the Millennium Group only took interest in after that? Did Mike go back and report it to someone? I guess you have to fill in the blanks for yourself. But as you say, from here on, it certainly becomes painfully aware that there's more going on beneath the surface, and it's quite foreboding.
It's a good point that with Mike Atkins, actually, because I mean, he appears twice in season one, but the first one, Gehenna, which is the one I covered, which was. I've never really thought about that, and it's certainly something that would be hard to weigh up between the two, as you say, because it is such a diverse change from the structure, really.
Yeah, I guess there's always ways of sort of explaining things away. Maybe Mike wasn't in on this stuff. Yeah. He seemed like such a nice guy after all.
Yeah, if I can structure my struggles in X-Files, I can structure anything. And I've managed to structure my own story of my struggles, so I'm all right. My struggles and Ghoulie I've managed to sort out. So if I can do that, I can do anything. So that's fine. So we also another little piece of the jigsaw that we get for later on is Frank being frustrated, like he obviously should be, and this is a character trait, really, I think, more than anything, that he shouts at Jordan.
Yes,
it's something that then reappears in Monster in the later episode in Monster, and the only thing that we've kind of linked up with that is that you do get this kind of this change, even though that we're aware he's really struggling here. But what did you think of that? The fact that they have seeded that for later on as well.
It's such a moment when he shouts at Jordan, because he's always been this sort of doting father, and I think that it says a lot about the character of Frank Black and his restraint, given everything, even in the face of everything that he deals with as part of his job. That moment of him shouting at Jordan feels like so out of character. And of course there's more to come later in the episode, but and Frank talks himself, I think, about the sort of dangerous levels of anger that he's feeling.
Yeah.
And obviously that plays into how the episode pans out. But I think it says something about how powerfully we identify with Frank Black as a character of such restraint and calm and integrity, as we've seen throughout the first season and to this point, that it's quite a shock, and it's all the more effective for that.
It kind of gets you a bit on edge, doesn't it? Because it's not something that you actually normally see in the show. You're not seeing that from Frank. While we're talking about Jordan as well, there is a saying which could quite easily go over a lot of people's heads in the first watch of this episode, where she does say, that there's angels over there.
Yeah.
And that obviously plays a big part. And I know that with Jordan's gift has been discussed, or lack of gift, or whatever you want to call it, if she does have one, doesn't. And then obviously we get episodes like Midnight of the Century. Frank Spotnitz kind of brought it up a little bit in Sacrament, and we get an element of it potentially in Dead Letters, I think it was. So by seeding this, what did you think of that aspect that Jordan has been seeded with this angels over there, and obviously when it comes up in Monster and Midnight of the Century and the episodes as we go on with Lara Means.
It's a really nice element in terms of how I think it's introduced in this, because it's the sort of thing you can imagine a kid just coming out and saying, and you might not think anything of it. But of course, she references a couple of times in the episode. I think she references the fact that they're gone later on in the episode when Catherine comes home. So clearly it's there and it's foreshadowing, but I think it's done in a again in an understated way that is all the more effective for that, and allows things to slowly be unveiled as we step through the season.
Yeah, and especially if, as you rewatch it, you just see these things that are seeded in. It's another one on my checklist. Love a tick.
There you go.
where it's just seeded in, and it's nicely done, because as I say, you would, I mean, people who have seen Likes of Sacrament, there is this inkling, would naturally think, oh, there might be an inkling of that. But, you know, no one would have any idea of the implementation that they would have later in the season with regarding angels and what happened. So it's a really interesting aspect of that. Mm. The next part I would like to really get from you is it's probably one of the most poignant and powerful scene, as far as I'm concerned, in entire run of season of all three seasons, actually. Also, the fact that it's such a poignant moment here, and that's Peter's story about the three daughters. Is there anything in your script about that at all, or and what did you think about that scene?
I'm scrambling for the script now. So it's a pivotal scene, isn't it? I mean, it's really at the heart and the center of the episode, and what it's about. This whole idea of sacrifice, and can you sacrifice one thing to get another? I really think it's core to it. Gives you some real insight into Peter's character and the way he thinks as well, and deepens his character. But of course, it's reflected by what Frank will have to sacrifice before the hour is up himself, and plays into the notion of the hero as someone who, you know, has to sacrifice and suffer at their core, and the sort of redemptive power in that and all that kind of thing. So it's one of my favorite scenes, certainly from the whole episode, and it's absolutely pivotal, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, Peter Watts has had a bit of a disservice in season one with some elements, feeling that he's a bit of an exposition machine in a lot of ways. he does have his moments, but this is by far. I actually, before I even rewatched this, I thought this was towards the end of season one, I must admit. When I rewatched it for, wherever it was, 6 months ago or whatever. And when I saw it here, it obviously fit into place. I was like, right, okay, this is where I remember it from. The way that Terry O'Quinn delivers that talk to Frank, and the way that, you know, it's my boy and things like that, was just so wrenching.
Yeah, it's fantastic scene. I'm just looking through the script here now. There's certainly some in the narrative description, there's some sort of direction for how Peter feels going into this scene. So when Frank's sat down at the table and he starts to say, you know, I guess deep down I knew, and the description here, so it says Frank sighs defeated, Watts averts his eyes, feeling, knowing his friend's agony, frustrated, tired, Frank's train of thought is scattered. And then it talks about the camera inches into Peter Watts as if he recognizes the larger meaning of Millennium within the words of Frank Black's crisis, and yet he looks away as if now is not the time, or perhaps Frank is not yet ready to know the full story.
Right. Okay. Interesting. That is very interesting. I'll be listening back to that later on. So I mean, as you mentioned there, I mean, the fact that Frank would have to sacrifice something to have Catherine back, it obviously foreshadows what's to come, and the chasm that happens and opens up between Frank and his ideal life in the Ella House with Catherine, and the ramifications of what happens at the end, which we'll pick up with a little bit once we get towards the end of the episode. But there's that idea of sacrifice overall, this middle part of the episode, I think, you know, I joked around before saying this was Frank going to get his girl, and he gets his girl, and you know, story's over. But I think this is the heart of the episode. And I think that,
absolutely,
without a doubt, this is probably, as I say, one of the strongest in all three seasons. And I hadn't really thought about it in that way until I started the rewatch, and I was like, oh, right, yeah, actually, yeah, I think this is a really powerful moment. But speaking of moments and change in style, we get introduced to Brian Rodecker. Yeah. Which is, as I alluded to before, which is where we get this Soylent Green is people from. So what were your thoughts when you first saw Brian and what was the other guy called?
Dickie Bird,
that's the one.
Yeah.
what were your thoughts on Dickie Bird and Brian Rodecker?
So again, I found it jarring because we're actually getting some comedy in an episode that's very tense and very very dark. So it felt quite jarring, and I didn't love Rodecker straight away. I have to say, I grew to appreciate Rodecker. I have to say, but I didn't love him straight away. However, we get that Soylent Green is people, which I just love that idea in that moment. It could be a little goofy, but I think as soon as you start getting used to hearing. Lance Henriksen say Soylent Green is people, and I'm like, yeah, okay, I forgive you, Rodecker. I'm on board. Yeah.
This is when we first see the Ouroboros on the computer screen. That was something that we're going to get throughout the whole season. With, I think the ones I can instantly recall is the Mikado and the main one, which is the Curse of Frank Black.
Yeah,
where it's used to absolutely brilliant effect. Mm-hmm. But in this scene, this is where we were talking before about the fact that Millennium Group are starting to hide things from Frank, or we find out that they are finding things from Frank.
Yeah.
And Peter's go deeper, but not into his soul for your sake, not his soul. The conversation that we've had and what you read out before with the script and the fact that he's not ready, but yet we're getting this scene now where Peter's having to do a bit of a tightrope walk between the two worlds, and something that he has to deal with a lot, especially in likes of Via Della Rosa and Goodbye to All That at the very end. But this is the first instance. So what do you think of that balancing act that Peter Watts has to run?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it feels like a test here for Frank, right? So they ultimately give him information about the Polaroid Stalker, and then it's given him a little information, just hooking him and then seeing how he responds, taking a step back and seeing what he does. It is an interesting balancing act, as you say. I think here, and that the first time we see it, it's almost as though the Millennium Group are feeling their way through it themselves and testing, seeing how Frank responds. So it's certainly interesting, and interesting too that it's a profile that we get the voiceover from the Polaroid Stalker. The profile itself is something different. It's something Frank's not able to understand in the way he has been the killers he's dealt with to this point.
He actually says, "I'm not fitting into the serial killer profile that he's come to understand," and that the reason why the Polaroid Stalker is interested in Frank is because they're interested in him as well. Yes. Which I think is a really poignant question and really poignant thing that's said. We get the monologue of the Polaroid Stalker saying things like he'll find the answer and he'll find the question. So this idea of the Ouroboros and the forever eating its own tail, and the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega, and all of that kind of talking, and they get the seven spirits of God that he starts to talk about. And I still have an issue with that scene. I think it's a powerful scene, but without really understanding it too much, is something that I would like to get. Probably stands on Michael J. Petty, his idea on these sort of things. He also has insight to that. But what were your thoughts on the aspects of the seven spirits of God and the way that he delivers that line, but also as well the fact that, again, another checklist is that this show is basically telling the audience, we're not a serial killer of the week. We are going to be something different moving forward.
It is very much part of the sort of the Morgan and Wong manifesto, isn't it? Is what it feels like. Doug Hutchinson certainly enjoys delivering this whole monologue, and it is a very powerful moment. I think actually I'd like to comment on Megan Gallagher's performance in that scene. It must have been quite a difficult episode for her, really, in terms of what she's given to do. And actually, she also plays it very well, and I think the two play off each other well, and really make it sort of heighten the scene itself. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the content itself, obviously it comes down to the notion of the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, and you know, then that ties back to the opening monologue and so on as well. I won't attempt to deconstruct some of the other religious imagery in here. I'll leave that to far more qualified people.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm still not fully appreciative on it. I wish I could be, and I wish I could understand it a little bit more. But it is something that that plays really well from a dramatic point of view. And as you say, the way that Megan Gallagher performs that, I mean, you can only imagine the amount of time that she would have spent in that episode, like she is. So the fact that she has to like go through that must be really hard.
There's one other element, if I can mention, as well. So there's, in amongst his taunting and questioning of Catherine, he does pose to her that the question of, you know, would she die for the sake of her daughter?
Yeah.
And again, yeah, who knows if that may come up again. The element of sort of foreshadowing and that's in there as well, I think is, it's very interesting and very smart, very well done.
Yeah, and also just with you saying that, just the juxtaposition of the fact that he does ask about the, you know, would Frank give his life for God as well? You know, the fact that he's asking Catherine that question, but he's asking Frank a more... spiritual and more, omnipotent question, really. So that's an interesting juxtaposition between the two. It is telling as well that Catherine, although she's labelled on the credits as the pretty much the second lead, that Terry O'Quinn gets more screen time over the episodes.
Absolutely. So,
which is an interesting aspect. What did you think of Catherine's treatment over the course of season two?
I guess just through the nature of where this episode leaves her and Frank, which I know we'll get to shortly. She ends up being, of course, sidelined some of the time. And I really enjoyed the episodes where she was given something to do. I love Luminary, and I think that's a very interesting episode in terms of their relationship. And I actually loved Anamnesis as well, and that episode where she really comes to the fore. So, as always, and really as with season one, I kind of wish she was given a little more to do, but I understand, you know, this is primarily Frank Black's journey and so on. But
yeah, I mean, you mentioned Luminary, and I think in a few episodes that where she's involved, I think, I can't remember if it's Owls and Roosters that she's in as well, where she confronts Peter and
yes,
all that aspect of that, I think, really works well from a personal point of view, that, you know, she's seen as this... This character that feels like she's had Frank taken away from her by the group. And that aspect, as well as Frank being in the position that he's in, but that aspect, it really works quite well. And I would have liked to have seen that more. I would have liked to have seen a bit more of that. And as I say, with Luminary, one of my memories of that episode is Catherine going to the house, Peter Watts' house, and, you know, basically asking Peter where he's going, and he just gives her a look. That whole scene, I thought that was really well done as well. So I do like the aspects of Catherine through the season, really.
Yeah, and Megan Gallagher is consistently great, I think, whenever she's given something to do, and whenever she's given something meaningful to do, especially so. Yeah.
So we get to the end of the episode. The Frank finds out that he's using all of his serial killer ability to profile this person, and he does eventually find the old house in which they used to live, which was sold 2 weeks after they came back to the Seattle area. And it's not only telling for the episode, but it's also pointing towards the profiler always being right as well, an aspect I think as well is an interesting play as well. Serial killer shows and profiling shows, generally they're always right, but this is kind of putting it on its head and going, no, we're not doing that. That's another little mark. But then we get he does sense, and this is where the gift is kind of coming in, that the Polaroid stalker is saying that he will stay there. He senses there's something there that he needs to see. He does see the photograph of the house.
Yep.
He eventually goes to that house, and I don't know if this was meant, and I don't know if anyone has picked this up, and I might be completely talking out of my rear end, but when he does get to the house where Catherine is, it feels like there's an inverted question mark on the floor with the Polaroids, which I thought was an interesting take.
I know the scene you mean, and I'm not sure that I've ever noticed that, but you could be absolutely right.
I'd have to go back and check. Absolutely, yes. I don't know why that would be, but if, for some reason on this last watch I did, I thought that looks like a question mark, but never mind. And we get the the discovery that Catherine is actually in the basement, and Catherine believes that Jordan is there as well, which he then says that he isn't, and the Polaroid stalker then attacks Frank, and then we get the final scene. Without even saying anything about the final scene, what are your first impressions of that whole entire scene from start to finish, once he gets into the basement, sees Catherine, right up to the point where the scene ends with the killing of the stalker?
I mean, first of all, it looks great. I think it's really well shot, and of course incredibly tense. Yeah, I guess I'm trying to think of how I felt the first time I watched it and what I expected to happen or whatever. But it's just the fact that you have this explosion of violence that you've not seen, of course, before from Frank Black again. And then and this notion of him crossing a line that he hasn't crossed, that we haven't seen him cross before. It's powerful and it's quite upsetting. In that respect.
Yeah. And the editing as well, with making use of the Polaroids.
Yes. Really good. Very, very effective. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought the editing on that was absolutely amazing. He does actually get killed as well. He does say, "You think you know them. You think you know me, Frank, but you don't know them."
Don't know them. Yeah.
Which is a pivotal line. And I think that that aspect of it is a really telling aspect. And as I say, going forward, I'm sounding like a broken record now, but going forward is really telling aspect. But the what were your thoughts on the stalker himself? I mean, he's the one goading Frank here. He's kind of like the he's not by any means to this level, like sort of what I said with Raymond Dees in 522666.
Okay,
because he's an overarching enemy as such, a kind of like a Moriarty figure. But he is goading him, and he is basically knowing that this is going to come to a head. He's put all the pieces in place and has got Frank to that area, and that was his whole plan all along. But what did you think of that aspect and why he did that and what the aspect of that was for him in opposition to Frank?
Yeah, and it's certainly ambiguous, and I suspect is meant to be ambiguous, right?
Yeah.
But you kind of think from the Polaroid stalker's perspective, how did he expect that to end? Actually, perhaps the whole point was to make Frank cross that line and to do what he does, and that's somehow a way of pulling him to the dark side, if you like, to go back and think about the sort of the tempting of Frank Black. Perhaps this is another expression of that. That's how I tend to see it.
Yeah.
But of course it is left with that ambiguity that we all know and love about Millennium.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. I mean, I'm not saying it is this, and I'm not, I wouldn't pose this as a question really, but there is an element of kind of a Legion-esque kind of feeling to it as well that, and I never really thought about that until this afternoon when I was having a quick skim through the episode, and I just thought, well, they could in some ways kind of push a Legion element to it.
Yep, absolutely.
So that's certainly something different. Now, that kind of brings the episode to a close, and we get to the final scene where we find that Frank is now leaving the L house. He's protected his family, but he has sacrificed himself. Is there anything you'd like to talk about with regards to the end of the episode and those scenes in particular?
So this felt particularly jarring to me on first watch as well. And I think going back and watching it again, I think it just feels a little rushed. So Catherine gets a girl, brings her back home, as you say, and they're reunited. And there is that great scene where, so Catherine's saying, you know, I don't know whether it's wrong what you did, and then there's this very pregnant pause. And Frank says, well, neither do I. But it seems almost odd that they've been pulled apart and they've been back in the house 5 minutes and they're both packing their bags. And I guess it makes sense. So in terms of the broader narrative and what is being set up for the rest of the season, we need to, Frank gets the girl back, but he loses the yellow house and you want to take that away from him and set him on this journey he's going to go on for the season. But to me, it almost felt like perhaps that needed another episode to play out or something, because it just felt too abrupt that one or other of them would make, after what they've been through, would they really? Would one of them just leave the house and separate? But so that struck me as a little odd on first viewing. But as with so many things like this, I think the performance. So it's heartbreaking because of the performances of Lance Henriksen, of Megan Gallagher in that scene, in that moment as well. So it's horrible, but it's meant to be. That's the whole point, right?
Yeah, I think this has been mentioned on by several different hosts and guests, and I think it will be in the future as well. That if this was made in the now, I think it would be a completely different beast, and that they would probably stretch that out a little bit more and let it play on and become more of a soap opera feel to it, and you know, really pull at the heartstrings of the fact, you know, that they're battling for the Yellow House, but in the end, because of what happened over two or three episodes, then that would be it. But obviously, you know, in the world that we are in, and bearing in mind that season two of Millennium, you know, has this through line and has these episodes with the likes of, you know, as I said before, Beware Monster and Single Blade of Grass and Curse of Frank Black, where it alludes to stuff, but it's not directly. You could put an episode of Millennium on and still watch it.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of prime kind of TV nowadays is more, prestige TV is more spread out over 10, 12 episodes.
Right, yeah. Like I say, I go with it because the sense of, okay, we're going to take the Yellow House away and the season becomes about him trying to get back to it. I can go with it from that sense. But it certainly was jarring on first watch again. Yeah.
That brings us to the end of the episode. Frank drives off and goes to his new home, which so I'm sure we'll talk about. Is there anything else that you would like to bring up with regards to the episode?
So if I can just go back to the script again, absolutely, for the very sort of closing moments in the script, because I think it's quite interesting in terms of the insight that Morgan won't bring to just the very final images we see of this scene. So it talks about Frank exits the house, holding his bag. So Cherokee pulls out of the driveway, begins to pull away before it stops. And you have that moment where he pauses outside the house. And this is how it describes that. So the camera slowly pushes into Frank as he looks at the Yellow House, and this next bit is underlined. So he is not defeated or sad.
Oh, right, okay.
It says, if he is overwhelmed, it is with the uncertainty as he understands this is the beginning of the journey and not the end. Right. Cherokee pulls away and disappears. Tonight, only the comet above needs to stand guard over the Yellow House. So I think that's quite telling in terms of the insight to the, and you get a sense of that again from the glance that Lance Henriksen takes. But I thought it was kind of telling, quite an interesting insight from the page of the original script.
Yeah, no, I really like that. I mean, the whole episode is with things that you've said on with regards to the script that. It is quite poetic, you know. You look at the beginning part, and you look at what to sacrifice, and then, as you say, the fact that the comet overlooking the Yellow House. I never thought of it that way. That's certainly something that is an interesting theme and aspect to think about, really.
Absolutely.
Anything else on the agenda? Anything in the script that pops out at you at all?
The only thing I meant to mention actually about the opening monologue was that having that opening monologue from one of the lead characters is always something I associated with Chris Carter.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is quite sort of Chris Carter-esque that they're doing this, but actually it's Morgan Wallen that wrote this. But then I actually, in my slightly nerdy way, went back and found a list of all those kind of opening monologues from the X-Files as well as Millennium. Mm. And the very first one, I think I'm right in saying, the very first one is in Little Green Men from Mulder, which is the season two, opener of season two of the X-Files, and was written by Glenn Morgan and James Wong.
Right.
So I wonder if it's actually something that we came to associate with Chris Carter because he did a lot of it, but actually the first time we see it in the 1013 universe, it's written by these guys, which was unexpected to me until I went back and did a bit of homework.
Okay, so if that's everything, we'll go into the mailbag. Michael Little says, I think this is a fantastic opening to what is ultimately a fantastic season. What's interesting is the teaser reminds me of Morgan and Wong channeling Chris Carter.
There you go.
So what I find really good about that is the fact that we've just done that in reverse, which is fantastic. Yeah, I love that. German Trout on Facebook said, my first thought is that I was thrilled by the continuing motive of the comet as a grim omen of things to come. I love that Millennium presented its ideas of overarching storytelling in such subtle pictures. It gave you the chance to see the episodes as standalones and as part of one great puzzle at the same time. It widened the universe of the first season and gave you many opportunities to make your own connections and explanations. but it's kept its low-key approach, especially because of the unique performance of Lance Henriksen. An interesting look upon it, especially with what you've just said about the script.
Yep, absolutely.
It gave you the chance to see episodes of standalones and part of one great puzzle that we've just literally just mentioned about Prestige TV. And the fact that it's widened the universe and it gives you opportunities to make your own connections and explanations, which is something I absolutely love in TV. One thing that really, really doesn't sit well with me is episodic procedural TV episodes where it's all tied up in a bow. I don't know about yourself, but that's certainly something that I don't mind watching the occasional Hawaii Five-0, for example. I do watch that, but that generally is like literally popcorn TV to me. That's something that I'll throw on when I don't want to think about anything.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I don't tend to be drawn to that sort of storytelling. I make an exception for Sherlock Holmes, and I think of the original Granada, Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes in that respect. So when it's done really, really well, I like it. But that sort of, crime procedural by numbers is less interesting. And I think perhaps this is one of the reasons we go back to a show like Millennium and a season like this, that ambiguity and the fact that it is so different from the vast majority of what appears on our TV screens.
He does mention the unique performance for Lance Henriksen. We mentioned obviously Megan Gallagher, but Lance again just pulls out of somewhere.
Absolutely. And not to keep harking on about the monologue, but I think just for Lance's voice, he has the most incredible voice. And so I'd be tempted to give him one of those monologues every week. Of course, it would become really boring if you did that. But I almost take that for granted, Lance's performance. But of course, he's fantastic throughout.
Well, speaking of Morgan and Wong and monologues, as long as it's not Chris Carter doing a monologue about going from a hospital and telling you exactly what's happening in a Ford car, then as we got in one of the Maestro goes, then I'm more than happy for him to do that. Which leads perfectly onto John Ifland. John Ifland basically says, best speech ever. I listened to the opening endlessly, and what he put a clip of the YouTube video of him doing that speech, which I thought was great, and I've had that on repeat myself. So yeah, so I definitely think it's I love a good monologue. I do love a good monologue. I joke about Mulder's monologues. A lot of people, as you say, some of it was Morgan and Wong, but some of Chris Carter's ones, things like I'm trying to think of ones where he's really did good, like with Syzygy and things like that, where he's had a really good speed. I love that, the hurling through time at space at 66,000 miles per hour. I can pretty much rhyme off in the top of my head. But I love those type of elements. And I think, as you say, I think Frank could have had some more that would have been really good.
I do as well. And I think that the vast majority of them are really well written. And again, they just stand out as being the sort of 1013 brand for me, because it's something that you don't see often. And when they're done well, I think they're very, very effective.
Yeah. And finally, Frank Black Jr. on Twitter, he said he didn't like the Millennium Group being evil. Even I don't think they were all evil. I respect that, but I just loved it because the idea of a group of people gathering power through the century second rule to rule the world. Because the idea of a group of people gathering power through the century to rule the world is interesting and sadly real. Also, the mythology was great. So yeah, he's saying about the Millennium Group. But what did you think? We mentioned Owls and Roosters earlier on when we were talking about season two. What did you think of the elements that was brought in into Millennium, the likes of the, obviously it being a cult, but then Owls and Roosters having this secular idea with the Owls and the Roosters and their ideas and how that all came out as we get towards the end of the season?
Well, I think it reflects some of the struggles that we see day to day in the news and in the real world. So I think it's almost a sort of a cipher for that. So I understand where people feel that the Millennium Group has been sort of transformed into this sort of hideous version of what they were originally, but dramatically, I think it's interesting and it feels like an appropriate avenue to explore in a show such as this. I think it's really effective. It's one of the best elements of the season.
Yeah, I do. I think that I know people said that I think it's a big change in the Academy Group. Like you said earlier on, I don't think it it necessarily was that, and you know, they've got to take some element of the group because of that's what was installed. But the fact that they're moving on to a new element of the show and a more of a mythos as such, then they needed to go down that route, and I really liked it. I have issues with it in season three, but season two I don't.
And I'm repeating myself again from the primer, but I think I mentioned then that even in the pilot, when Peter Watts first shows up at the Yellow House, he's there outside in the shadows, in the dark, and there was something foreboding and mysterious, and that we didn't quite know everything we needed to about him even then.
So yes,
yeah. I think it's seeded way back at the start.
Yeah, and you don't need to worry about the primer. That was 23 episodes ago now. So we're okay. I'm sure there's lots of things being repeated several times over the course of the show, and that's why we love it. That's why we want to talk about it and talk about elements of the show that we particularly love. But as I say, I mean, the element of Millennium becoming this group, I really enjoyed it. I specifically loved the Owls and Roosters idea, and I wish that could have been delved into more. That was kind of my take on that. So yeah, that comes to the end of the show. But before we do. We are at the beginning of season two. So this is the very first episode. We have an interesting arc that comes moving forward. Which episodes are you most looking forward to hearing on the podcast?
So I think certainly Luminary.
Yeah.
I call that out as my all-time favorite episode, and it is. So definitely interested to hear what folks say about that.
Yeah.
The two-parters, so Owls, Roosters, and Fourth Horseman, The Time Is Now. And the Darren Morgan episodes as well, I think. So some of the real standout episodes. I'm very much interested to hear what folks have to say about all of those and more.
Well, I've definitely made sure, well, fingers crossed anyway, I've definitely made sure that I am on the two Jose Chungs and Somehow Satan Got Behind Me. So I need to stake my claim on that without a doubt. So that leaves it for the end of the beginning and the end. This has been a fantastic little discussion. Thank you for bringing the script out. It's, that's been an added bonus today. So I think that's been really good. I'm sure people will appreciate that.
Cool, no, you're welcome.
But until next time, we will see you all for Beware of the Dog. And that should be a really interesting episode. It's certainly one that's a bit out there. But until that show comes on, how can people find you online first?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter, Adam_Chamberlain, just spelled LN at the end. Also at fourthhorsemanpress.com, which is obviously where you can find out a bit more about the Back to Frank Black book.
Fantastic. Okay, you can find me at R Muldrake. That's R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. And that's on Twitter. The Time Is Now, as you'll hear in the credits, is at The Time Is Now Pod. Feel free to jump into the Yellow House Facebook group on Facebook as well, where there's plenty of discussion going on there. There's been some reviews and things like that. There's new group members happening all the time, coming on all the time, which is great to see. So I'd like to get a lot of conversation on in there. But remember, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music and beyond, including our sister show The X-Cast and X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.